by Addie Baum. Remember when you were little and I let you stay up late so we could watch Upstairs, Downstairs? That show always made me think about Mrs. Morse's troubles with George and how Miss Lettuce never found out. It wasn't because she was stupid or because we were so smart. She was just busy with upstairs dramas, like the girl who got appendicitis. But she went into a full panic when she was told to expect a newspaper reporter who was coming to do a story about Rockport Lodge. It might not sound like a big deal, but publicity like that had never been welcomed by the women who started Rockport Lodge. They grew up thinking that a lady's name should never appear in the paper, except when she got married and when she died. But that had changed, and those women and their daughters read the society pages, whether they admitted it or not, especially in the Boston Evening Transcript, which ran a genealogy column every week and reported on the kinds of women's clubs attended by Boston's first families. I'm talking about the Lowells and the Cabots and that set. The Transcript was like People magazine for Beacon Hill types, and the rest of us, too. Miss Lettuce got a phone call from the chairman of the lodge board and was told to expect a certain Miss Smith, and to make sure she left with a delightful impression. Everything had to look its best, which meant I polished the banister twice and dusted every damn book in the house. The night before the big visit, Miss Lettuce sat down in the kitchen, something she never did, and went over the lunch menu with Mrs. Morse. She was nervous as a cat, folding and unfolding her hands and telling us more than she was probably supposed to. She said our visitor was the most popular society writer in Boston, so we had to put our best face forward or the whole world would hear about it. Miss Lettuce came from Pittsfield, so she didn't know that Miss Smith had to be Serena, who wrote a column called Out and About. Everyone read it, not only because she had the juiciest gossip, but also because sometimes she poked fun at the people she wrote about, like the time she said Beacon Hill ladies were such penny pinches they wore their shoes until the soles were thin as communion wafers. Nobody knew Serena's real name. There was a rumor that she was from a first family herself, which would have made her a traitor to her class, and even more fascinating. Some people argued that she had to be a man because a woman couldn't be that witty. When the car pulled up in front of the lodge, I felt like a detective solving the mystery of Serena's true identity. Reading all those newspapers paid off, because the minute I laid eyes on her, I knew it turned out that she was a Mrs. Charles Thorndike. Case closed. When a Brahmin like Tessa Cooper marries a Brahmin like Charles Thorndike, there was always an announcement in the paper, and sometimes a picture of the bride. Miss Nellie Cooper had sent every editor in town a photo that showed off a bare shoulder, very racy. Miss Lettuce had put on her best welcome face, but when she saw three cameras hanging from the driver's neck, she gasped, "I didn't get permission for pictures," and ran inside to call Boston for instructions, leaving Miss Smith high and dry. She perched on the porch railing and lit a cigarette. The portrait didn't do justice to her heart-shaped face and big eyes. Her dark hair was almost as short as a man's and parted on the side, a style you might have seen in a fashion magazine, but much too much for Boston. I must have been feeling very brave that morning, because I went right out there and said, "Would you like something cold to drink, Mrs. Thorndike?" She looked surprised at hearing her name, but then she smiled and shrugged. "You read the papers, do you? I could do with a drink, but I don't suppose you have a gin fizz handy." I didn't know what to say. It was 11 o'clock in the morning in the middle of Prohibition. She laughed. "Relax, child. I'm joking. Are you here from one of the girls' clubs?" I wasn't about to tell her I was the maid, so I said I was a member of the Saturday Club, which was true. She knew who we were. Mother's Missionary Society brought all their Christmas presents from your little shop a few years ago. Are you one of those adorable pottery girls? Adorable? She was getting on my nerves. I said no, that I was a secretary in a real estate office and taking classes at Simmons College. That makes you a real go-getter, as well as a fan of the gossip columns. That rubbed me the wrong way, too. So I said, the society pages were a big waste of time, except for Serena. Then I looked her right in the eye and said, I get a kick out of the way you poked fun at Boston's High and Mighty. That wiped the smug little smile off her face. Miss Lettuce reappeared, calmer now that she had her marching orders. There would be no pictures inside the lodge and no pictures of the girls. Doesn't leave much, does it? Said Mrs. Thorndike. She stood up and flicked her cigarette out on the lawn. It must have taken all of Lettuce's self-control not to run over and pick it up. Let's get this over with. They went off on a grand tour that had been carefully laid out. They stopped at the tennis court, where it just so happened that the two best players were in the middle of a game, and from there paid a visit to a group of well-groomed girls who were reading poetry to each other. Another bunch was crocheting handbags, all of it phony as a $3 bill. Tessa Thorndike didn't seem all that interested. She didn't talk to any of the girls or write down a word of what Miss Lettuce told her about the history of Rockport Lodge or what happened there. Instead of eating lunch in the dining room with everyone else, she had her lunch on a tray in the parlor by herself. The lodge emptied out in the afternoon for a sailboat ride out of Rockport Harbor. Miss Lettuce took the photographer to take pictures of the grounds and the house, and Mrs. Thorndike went back to the porch to smoke. I wandered out there with a book under my arm. No sailing, she said. I said I got seasick and asked if she was having a good time. She sighed. Not really. I'm on a tight leash. No funny business allowed. She sounded discouraged and less snooty. The only reason I'm here is that Charles's mother gives money to this place and told the publisher she wanted something nice. If I were to be even a little bit clever, she would not be pleased. I asked if her mother-in-law suspected that she was Serena. Mother Thorndike would make her son divorce me. She finds Serena vulgar, but Charlie thinks she's funny. He's right, I said. Why, thank you, she said, and asked my name. She said, Addie Baum. That would make a good byline. And just like that, I could see it in my head. By Addie Baum, in black and white. That's what I wanted to do with myself. I would write for the newspapers. I had goosebumps, but I pulled myself together and said, I don't think I could remember things as well as you do. You mean because I don't take things down? That's only because I'm lazy and nobody really cares what I write, long as I get the name straight and they have someone else to check to make sure that I do. I said that she was a good writer, but she shrugged off the compliment. I send over a few pages or call the editor and read what I've got on the phone, but I'm always late and he's always mad. I've often thought what I need is an assistant to help with actually getting things on paper, seeing they're in on time. It's all I can do to remember who was at which party, especially after a highball or two. I said, I took dictation and typed. Do you? She looked me over and said, what wouldn't she give for some of my curves? I would have given anything to be able to wear her dress, which fell in a straight line from her shoulders to her knees. You'd have to be at the house a lot, she said. If we were in New York, I could tell people you were my social secretary, but that's not done in Boston. And I can't say you're a friend because everyone knows all my friends. I said, couldn't we have met at Barnard? Something else I knew about her from her wedding announcement. She said, you have the memory of an elephant. But since they all went to Smith or Wellesley, I suppose I could introduce you as a college chum. The photographer was putting his cameras in the car, waved for her to get in. I gave him my telephone number at work. She shook my hand and said she'd call me in September. I watched them drive away and started planning the rest of my life. I wouldn't have to be Levine's secretary forever, but I would have to learn all about Barnard College and New York City if I was going to pretend to be her college chum. What would I call her? Mrs. Thorndike or Tessa? I could imagine how proud Miss Chevalier would be to see "By Addie Baum" in the newspaper. I couldn't wait. My jaw hurt from keeping quiet. Instead of dreading going back to work for my brother-in-law, I couldn't wait to get to the office in case Tessa called. By then, I was calling her Tessa in my head. I went in early and left late so I wouldn't miss her. I even decided not to sign up for night school so I'd be free, night or day, to do whatever she needed. The minute I heard from her, I was going to quit my job and start a whole new life. After a month without a word from her, I was going crazy. Maybe she'd forgotten me, or maybe she decided it was crazy to hire a complete stranger, or maybe someone told her that I was the maid. I read the newspapers like a maniac, right down to the box scores and the classifieds, thinking that eventually I'd find something about Mrs. Thorndike. I knew she liked having her name in the columns. Finally, I saw an item in the Herald about how the Charles Thorndikes were enjoying their stay in London, where Mr. Thorndike was doing business. After that, they were planning to spend a few weeks in Paris before returning to their Back Bay home. That explained why I hadn't heard from her. Either she had forgotten me or had forgotten that she was going on a trip to Europe when we talked. I wondered if there was still a chance that she'd call when she got back. I felt like a fly stuck on a piece of flypaper and wasted a lot of time feeling sorry for myself. Irene started talking about dosing me with Lydia Pinkham's again, and Betty said no sourpusses at her party. In December, Betty gave herself a birthday party. Mama thought making a fuss about birthdays wasn't just a waste of money. It was like waving a flag at the angel of death. It wasn't a big party, just the family, a cake with candles, and a bottle of homemade schnapps. Betty had bought herself a new outfit, which was an occasion in itself. She hadn't gotten anything new since the twins were born, because she'd been trying to lose the baby weight. Betty had never been skinny, and she was never really fat. She had still a nice shape, but it was well upholstered now, and her new dress made the best of it. But the real reason Betty wanted us all together was to make an announcement. "You'll never guess what Herman got me for my birthday," she said. "A house!" She could hardly get the words out fast enough to tell us about how many bedrooms there were and so many trees in the backyard. Herman was buying bicycles for the boys and a washing machine for her. Levine gave her a kiss on the cheek and said the house was too good a deal to pass up. My parents were stunned. Betty laughed. "Look at them. Don't worry, you're coming with us. Mama can grow cabbages and Papa won't have to work anymore. No rent to pay. It's a two-family. We have the top two floors and you'll be downstairs, just like here." Levine said there was a grocery store around the corner and a kosher butcher. "They have Jews there?" Mama said. "In Roxbury?" he said. "Are you kidding?" Betty said Mrs. Kempinski from the old apartment building was living there already with her son and daughter-in-law. She said to tell you hello and to visit as soon as you can. Papa's face was like a mask. "You talk like it's all settled, like I'm too old and sick to work, like I am not still the head of my own house." "Of course you are," Levine said. "If you want to keep working, I understand. There's even a trolley near us." Betty started talking about how much quieter it was in Roxbury and how there were better schools for the boys. Levine said the neighborhood was coming up. My mother asked if there was a fish store close enough to walk to. And then, boom, Papa slammed his fist on the table. "We are not going anywhere." It was like the clock stopped. My father never did things like that. Even Betty was speechless. Mama said, "What do you mean we aren't going? I'm going. Without me, your grandsons would grow up like wild animals. You do whatever you want. Stay here and starve. He said, Addie will keep house for me. She can't even boil water. Mama threw up her hands. Ah, what do I care? You can both starve. They went around and around for a long time. Levine explained, Betty argued, and Mama yelled until finally my father stood up. You can talk until the Messiah comes, but I am not going anywhere. On the way out, he slammed the door so hard the cups on the table jumped. Levine turned to me. What's going on? I thought this would make him happy. Happy was not a word I would put together with my father or my mother, but I told him that the problem was my father's synagogue. After Lenny died, my father had gotten more religious. He started working the night shift so he could pray in the morning on his way home and ate an early supper so he could pray before he punched in. He made his schedule so he didn't work on Saturdays and spent most of it at shul. Papa was a different person when he was there. At home, he was quiet, aloof even. But when he walked in there, men would run over to shake his hand, and he would smile and say things that made them laugh. He was an important man there, a scholar. Levine apologized to Papa. They should have asked him first, and of course, if Papa wanted to stay put, he could always move later if he wanted. But if he did come, there was a synagogue a few blocks from the new house. It had a big library with a whole Talmud and electric lights so you could read at night. The rabbi had a long white beard. He's not American, Papa asked. Levine said, I think he's from Germany. Even worse. Levine gave up. There was no way he could change Papa's mind. But it turned out that he didn't have to because the landlord kicked my father's synagogue out of the storefront and Avram, the caretaker, was moving to Roxbury. Avram told Papa that he'd been to Levine's temple and said that the library was pretty good, which was like an A+. He also said that the rabbi wasn't bad for a German, which was high praise coming from a Hungarian. So in the end, Papa moved to Roxbury with everyone else. But I did not. I didn't say anything about my plans until the day they were moving. Just as the truck pulled up, I told my parents that I had taken a room in Mrs. K's boarding house on Tremont Street. It was a very respectable place, and Betty told me to mention that it was mostly Jewish ladies who lived there, as if that would make a difference. My father made a sour face, but he didn't look surprised, which made me think that Betty had told him in advance. My mother was a different story. She gave me a look like I was a worm. I should be glad you're going to a Jewish whorehouse. And that was just the beginning. I was disobedient and stubborn. I was disrespectful. I never told her what I was doing or where I was going. I was a disappointment, a fool. I had a big head. The longer she went on, the madder she got. Finally, she said, "You'll be sorry, and don't come back when you're in the gutter." My jaw hurt from keeping quiet. I had promised myself I wouldn't fight, but inside my head I was screaming, "Don't call me a whore. Why does reading books give me a big head? Why don't you ever ask what I'm reading? The gutter? Who's been paying your rent?" "You don't even look at me when I talk to you," Mama screamed. "Get out of here. Go. I'm finished with you." Betty said, "Don't be ridiculous." "Look who's talking, the big shot. I blame you for this, you and that husband of yours. All you care about is money and making a big impression. I know you think I'm a nothing, a greenhorn, but you two are peasants, climbers. I only hope your children treat you the way you treat me." Betty told me, "Don't pay attention." Levine slipped me $5 and said, "She doesn't mean it." I used to dream about how wonderful it would be on the day I went to live on my own. But what I remember about that day is running to the curb and throwing up. The boarding house was cheap and clean, but my room was dark and smelled like mothballs. Actually, the whole building smelled like that, even the dining room. I was the youngest person there by 30 years and the only one who went to work. The rest were spinsters or widows living on pensions, and all of them were lonely. If I took a book into the parlor, one of them would sit down by me and complain about Mrs. K, the landlady, or an ungrateful niece who never visited, or how the other women in the house gossiped about each other. They all agreed that things were better in the old days. Some of them were sad about it, and some were bitter, but it was always nothing is as good as it used to be. I swore I would never talk like that, and you know what? Now that I'm an old lady myself, I think that most things are better than they used to be. Look at the computers. Look at your sister, the cardiologist, and you graduating from Harvard. Don't talk to me about the good old days. What was so good? Even with the old ladies and the mothballs, I loved not having to explain where I was going or where I'd been. It was like being on a vacation from my family. I talked to Betty a lot. She and Levine got a telephone for the house, and the two of them talked at least 3 times a day. She called me, too, and asked what I was up to and when I was coming for dinner, which I didn't do too often. I knew I should have been looking for another job, but I couldn't stop hoping that Tessa Thorndike would rescue me when she came back to Boston. From the society pages, I found out she was home. Mrs. Thorndike had been seen at a tea wearing a strange black dress, very French for New England, which meant that everyone hated it. A week after that, Serena's column returned to the Evening Transcript with a note about Mrs. Thorndike's recent appearance in a très chic Parisian ensemble by the world-famous designer Coco Chanel. Not that anyone in Boston was familiar with Chanel, or even knew how to pronounce her name. You had to admire the chutzpah of how she praised herself, but I finally realized that she was never going to call me. If I wanted a change, I'd have to do it myself. For months, Irene and Gussie had listened to me talk about Serena and how she was going to hire me, a little too much, I guess. Because when I said I wasn't waiting around anymore, Irene said, "It's about time." Gussie said she'd make some calls and told me to start looking at the help wanteds. There were a lot of openings for typists, and some of them looked interesting. I wanted to apply at Wellesley College, but it would have taken hours on the trolley. I inquired about working in a doctor's office. That would get me into a whole different world. But when I called, the job had already been filled. Irene said she'd keep her ears open, too, which meant listening in on calls she thought might lead to something. Not entirely kosher, I know, but Irene said nobody was going to give girls like us anything, so we had to take our chances wherever we found them. She didn't even say hello when I picked up the phone. "The typist in the transcript newsroom just quit. Put on your coat and get over there now." It made me feel like a real Boston girl. It was already 4 in the afternoon when Irene called, so I didn't get to the transcript building until after 5. The lobby was almost deserted, but I thought, what the heck, I'm here. So I asked a man about where I'd go about a typing job in the newsroom. He said, go to the 2nd floor and see if Mr. Morton was still around, but not to bother if I couldn't type fast. Then he winked. It won't matter to him how pretty you are. I was always surprised when people told me I was pretty. I couldn't see it then, but when I look at old pictures of me, I have to say I was kind of cute. After I lost the baby fat on my face and cut my hair, my eyes seemed bigger and my nose looked smaller, and I was very lucky with my teeth. When I look at my 85-year-old face in the mirror today, I think, you're never going to look better than you do today, honey, so smile. Whoever said a smile is the best facelift was one smart woman. Anyway, the man saying I was pretty made me smile, and I went upstairs feeling a little less nervous. I walked into a big room that looked like a hurricane had been through it. There was paper all over the floor. The trash cans and ashtrays were overflowing, and it smelled of cigar smoke. It looked like the newsrooms you see in the movies, only with cockroaches. Nobody was there. The transcript was an evening paper, which meant that everyone would be long gone. In my head, I was saying, damn, 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 but one of those dams must have come out of my mouth, because I heard a voice say, ha! A fat man with a hat pushed back on his head walked out from behind a glass door at the far end of the room. I said I was looking for Mr. Morton about a job. He gave out another ha and said, you're looking for me. I'm here about a job, I said. The typing job, right? Don't tell me you think you're the next Nellie Bly. I had no idea who that was. I just said that I could type. Fast? Very fast, and I'm good at dictation. He told me to hold out my hands, and I silently thanked Miss Powder for her rule about short nails. You would have to answer the telephone. I said I had a lot of experience at that. What would you do if some crackpot called in hollering about the Bolsheviks in the police department, like it was your fault? Why would anyone call about that, I said. The police strike was 5 years ago. He had a double chin and a heavy 5 o'clock shadow, but he grinned like a little boy when he said, ha. I thought he was laughing at me, but I found out that ha could mean anything from what a jerk to good morning or even you're hired. That particular ha meant I was hired. My first month there was a blur. I never worked so hard, not even cleaning at Rockport Lodge, because I was trying to do everything perfectly, and also because I was doing everything. I ran upstairs to the business office, downstairs to the press room, and back up to the advertising office. I went out for cigarettes and bottles in brown paper bags from the pharmacist. I answered the phone and listened to a lot of crackpots who complained about everything. Their neighbor's dog, women drivers, broken streetlights, President Coolidge's stand on immigration. Mort, he said he'd fire me if I ever called him Mr. Morton, said that the telephone was a curse except when you needed it, like when a reporter didn't have time to get back to the office to file a story. There were days I went home with a terrible stiff neck from taking dictation with the receiver between my ear and my shoulder. You have no idea how heavy those things used to be. I did all the typing for the older reporters who refused to learn how. The younger ones used two fingers, but they were fast. The guy who covered the courts was faster than me, but he was also a terrible drunk. Sometimes he'd come in an hour before deadline, type his story, and pass out at his desk. I couldn't believe that anyone that pie-eyed could write so well. But one day he was just too far gone and turned in a real mess. Mort told me to clean it up as well as I could, and he'd finish it. Let me tell you, I slaved over those two pages, and I was a nervous wreck when I turned them in. Mort moved my ending to the beginning, took out all the adjectives, cut the whole thing in half, made it 100% better. That's how it's done, he said. Best writing lesson I ever had. Not that he wanted me to be a reporter, God forbid. Mort disliked women reporters. They always stick themselves in the middle of the story. The stunt girls show off how brave they are, pretending to be a lunatic or a housemaid, and the sob sisters tell you too much about the murderer's clothes and nothing about the gun. He didn't have such a great opinion of men reporters either, and there were plenty of bad examples in that newsroom. Not just drinkers, but married men who kept asking me out to dinner. Mort said if he saw me with any of them, he'd fire me on the spot. Not that I expect you to be here very long, he said. The smart ones leave fast, and the good-looking ones go even faster, so I figure I've got you for 6 months tops. Then he asked if I'd met Sam Gold in sales. Nice boy, not married, one of your tribe, you could do worse. Don't be such a yenta, I said. I've been called worse things than a matchmaker. That time I said, ha! Obviously, I wasn't Mort's first Jew. He and I had what you would call a mutual admiration society, which is why he kept me away from the women's pages, or as Mort called it, the goddamn ladies' room. He hated the stories about clothes, cooking, makeup, parties and teas, women's clubs, charity events. Fluff and nonsense. But it was popular with readers, and the society types followed that genealogy column the way my nephews read about the Red Sox. Except for the columns, the whole section was written by two middle-aged women who never took off their hats. Miss Flora, who was tall and fat, and Miss Catherine, who was tall and skinny, could turn out copy faster than anyone in the newsroom, which was a good thing since the women's pages kept growing. The soap companies and department stores wanted their advertisements to appear next to stories their customers would probably read. Mort used to mutter, "Pretty soon they're going to have to change the name of the paper to the goddamn Ladies' Home Journal." But nobody hated the section more than its editor, Ian Cornish. His nickname was the Bantam because he had red hair and a voice like a trumpet. I once saw him stand on top of his desk and holler, "I am in hell." He was about 30 years old with nice green eyes and a cleft chin like Cary Grant's, but I never cared for pale men with red hair. I think they look like shrimp that have been boiled and peeled. Cornish had been sent to the hen coop, as he called it, as punishment for a fistfight he'd had with someone upstairs. He figured he'd be called back to the news desk after a few weeks, but when he realized he was stuck with the ladies, he started coming in late and never spent more than 2 or 3 hours in the office. Flora and Catherine were so good at their jobs it didn't make much difference, but when two more pages got added to the section, Cornish had to produce something too. Serena hadn't turned anything in for months, so he started a new column about women's clubs, parlor lectures, and private salons. Those were like book clubs today, but more formal. The toniest ones competed with each other for famous guest speakers. Cornish called his column Seen and Heard under the name Henrietta Cavendish, and he didn't write one single word. It was all copied straight out of the morning papers, which he cut up and left all over his desk as if he was daring someone to catch him. He got away with it for so long, it was clear that none of the higher-ups were reading his column, not even Mort. I didn't have anything to do with the women's section. Flora and Catherine didn't need help, and Cornish could type, or he could until the day he showed up with his right hand in a sling from punching someone who called him Mary because of where he worked. Mort wasn't happy about sending me over there. He had four daughters, and he treated me as if I were his fifth. He thought Cornish was a weasel and warned him to be a gentleman or he'd break the other hand. But Cornish was all business. He handed me copy to type without a please and took it back without a thank you and never looked me in the eye. The first time he said two words to me was the day he gave me a piece of fancy stationery, holding it between his thumb and forefinger as if it were a dirty handkerchief. "Type this right away," he said. "Her Highness Serena has decided to grace us with her wit, and we've got 20 minutes to rip up the section and fit it in." I said, "Well, she is the best writer in the section." He seemed surprised that I could talk. "You may be right, but she's a royal pain in the ass. She writes whatever she pleases, and I have to put up with it because the public likes her, and so does the publisher. It's a darn shame she's rich, because if she was hungry, she might be a real spitfire." That column wasn't one of Serena's best. Most of it was about the engagement party of a young woman who was probably a friend, since it didn't contain a single sly or snappy word. Catherine or Flora could have knocked it off in 5 minutes. I know it's not nice to enjoy someone else's failure, but Tessa Thorndike never called me, so I did take a little pleasure realizing how mediocre it was. You won't hold that against your dear old grandma, will you? After a few weeks on the women's pages, I had to agree with Mort that it was a big waste of time. Freckle removal recipes, tips on sweet-smelling breath, hemline news, and society drivel. Cornish's column was the worst, a stolen list of intimate events, with a roll call of the women who went to lovely teas and listened to intriguing lectures in charming homes. It didn't matter. Seen and Heard was almost as popular as the genealogy column, and for the same reason, people liked seeing their names in the paper. Cornish's hand healed fast, thank goodness, but a few days after I went back to my regular job, Mort called me to his office. He was holding the telephone and said that Cornish was calling in sick, and Catherine was at home with a dying mother, which meant I would be spending the whole day in the hen coop with Flora. He wants to talk to you. When I picked up the phone, he said, "Is this Baum?" That was the first time Cornish had ever used my name. "You're going to write my column today." "Me?" He said, "Why not? You're smarter than a monkey," and told me to go to the newsstand on the corner and ask for his copies of the Herald, the Globe, the Advertiser, and the American. Write about any gathering of respectable females and look at the pictures. Sometimes you can get an item out of a caption. Just make sure you spell the names right. That was my first newspaper assignment. It wasn't exactly a stop-the-presses moment, but I was excited. As I started to put it together, I realized that there was a strict pecking order to the lists of names. You always begin with the very first of the first families. Adamses, Cabots, Lodges, Winthrops, and such, followed by other well-known names, then club offices, married women, unmarried socialites, and at the bottom of the heap, spinsters of a certain age such as, and there she was, Miss Edith Chevalier. I felt a shiver go up my spine when I saw her name, and finally understood why people were so keen on reading those columns. Knowing Miss Chevalier meant that I was somehow connected to important goings-on in the city. It made me feel like a real Boston girl. I made sure I got everybody spelled right and turned it in before the deadline, but Flora handed it back without even looking at what I'd written. Some big advertisements had just come in and they had to add a whole page to the section. "I don't suppose you could give me possibly 6 more inches in the next half hour?" She obviously didn't think I could, so I said it wouldn't be a problem. The first thing I did was add the names of all the lecturers and what they talked about. In my opinion, it made the whole column much more interesting. The president of the League of Women Voters talked about why aren't women voting. An English professor from Smith College explained The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. A lady doctor spoke about Sigmund Freud's sex theory. Miss Chevalier had been at a gathering where a retired schoolteacher talked about her trip to Egypt with magic lantern illustrations. But even with all that, I was still short, and there was nothing left to steal. I was not about to go back to Miss Flora with my tail between my legs, so I came up with what I thought was a brilliant idea. I picked up the telephone and asked to be connected with the main branch of the Boston Public Library. Miss Chevalier was surprised to hear from me. When I told her I was writing about her club meeting for the Boston Evening Transcript, she sounded delighted and was glad to tell me about the lecture. She said she'd been transported. The speaker was a 75-year-old woman who had traveled all over the world by herself. Egypt was her most recent adventure. I wish you could have seen the pictures of that spry old lady sitting on a camel in front of the Great Pyramids. I had been taking down everything she said and asked if I could put some of her comments into my story. I said I didn't have to use her name. It could say, according to one of the ladies in attendance, but Miss Chevalier didn't mind if I quoted her, long as I included her full title, Supervisor for Circulation at the Central Branch of the Boston Public Library. After I was done that day, I stood at the back door of the transcript building and stopped the first paperboy who walked out with a stack of newspapers, which were, honest to goodness, hot off the press. I tore open a copy and found my story, just the way I had written it, including Miss Chevalier's comments, word for word, right there in Seen and Heard, by Miss Henrietta Cavendish. I must have known I wouldn't get credit. Couldn't have come as a surprise, but I still remember feeling like a little girl whose lollipop had just been snatched out of her hands. Nice turn of phrase. I didn't expect anyone but a few friends and Miss Chevalier to notice she'd been mentioned in the column, but I was wrong. The next morning, there were at least a dozen phone calls from women wanting to know why Mrs. Taylor's book group had gotten special treatment. Mrs. Taylor herself called to ask why Miss Cavendish had spoken to that librarian when she had a Ms. Saltonstall in her parlor. The publisher was happy about the attention and told Mort to keep up the good work, which meant more work for Cornish. The other papers weren't running quotations, but they started a few weeks after us. Cornish was not pleased. "I am not going to talk to those damn blue stockings, and you don't want me to. Do I sound anything like Miss Henrietta goddamn Cavendish?" Mort told Cornish to get Flora or Catherine to do the interviews, but for the first time anyone could remember, they said no. Miss Catherine said either he was joking or he was playing with fire. Miss Flora said this was the straw that would break the camel's back. They were masters of the cliché, those two. And that's how I became Henrietta Cavendish. Cornish saw his chance and handed me not just the interviews, but responsibility for the whole column. "You're a bright kid," he said. "You understand how this works. Just keep the publisher happy and everyone leaves us alone." Cornish was right when he'd said a smart monkey could put the column together. It wasn't hard. If Cornish was in the building when I turned it in, he'd give my pages a quick once-over, and Catherine did a final edit. It didn't occur to me how much I'd bitten off with writing a column twice a week, on top of the typing and errands and phone calls. It didn't occur to me to ask for a raise. I was over the moon. I spent every spare moment, and not just when I was at work, trying to make the column as interesting as I could. Club women started sending biographies of their speakers and lists of their guests in advance. Sometimes they included the menu, and I even got a few engraved invitations. Well, Miss Cavendish got them. There were days I felt like I was in over my head, like when there were too many invitations and every lecture was about flower arranging. If Flora and Catherine hadn't helped me sift and sort, I would have been sunk. But they appreciated hard work, and they knew I had no one else to turn to. I wouldn't ask Cornish for the time of day. He treated the three of us like we were servants or children, and only talked to me if word came down from upstairs that the publisher wanted a particular friend or relative mentioned. Sometimes that meant I had to write about the stupidest things you can imagine. The worst was the scientific evidence that fairies exist. I'm not making that up. I had been writing the column for a month when Miss Cavendish got a note directly from the publisher telling her to attend the next meeting of Harvard Faculty Wives, which was being hosted by his sister-in-law. "Doesn't he know there is no Miss Cavendish?" I asked Cornish. "Kiddo, I'd bet a week's salary that he's never even looked at our chicken scratches." Then he told me to tell the sister-in-law that Henrietta was coming down with a terrible cold and she was sending me, her secretary, to take notes for her. To me, it sounded like a great adventure. I couldn't wait. The meeting was on a Friday afternoon in a part of Cambridge I'd never been to. I felt like a tourist. The mansions on Brattle Street, just as big as the ones in Rockport, but older. The home I ended up at wasn't the biggest one on the street, but very elegant inside. A maid wearing a uniform and a cap answered the door, took my coat, asked for my name. For a girl who grew up in a cold water flat, it was like walking into a dream or a movie. It was chilly outside, but it felt like a June afternoon in that room, and not just because of the fireplace. The place was covered with roses, on the sofa, the rug, and the curtains, even on the china, pink roses. The maid introduced me as Miss Abby Brown. That brought me down to earth. I couldn't be Addie Baum, even when I was pretending to be the imaginary secretary of an imaginary columnist. Most of the women at the meeting were old, but the hostess couldn't have been more than 30 and very fashionable, which was rare in Cambridge in those days. Still is, don't you think? I don't remember her name, but when I explained why I was there instead of Miss Cavendish, she sent me to the back of the room so I wouldn't disturb anyone with my note-taking. She was perfectly polite about it, but I still felt as insulted and embarrassed as that night I tried to play charades at Rockport Lodge. I stopped feeling sorry for myself the moment the speaker walked in. She was a black woman with gray hair and short string of pearls around her neck. Mrs. Mary Holland, that's a name I never forgot, was there to talk about the anti-lynching crusade. Mrs. Holland was a grandmotherly type with a kind face, but her message was about as far from grandmotherly as you can get. She was there to shock and rally those women to her cause. She started with a story about a sober, church-going Negro man who was lynched because he opened a grocery across the street from a white man's store. Her eyes filled as she talked about a sweet 12-year-old boy who had been murdered for smiling at a white girl. There were thousands of stories like that, she said, and 100 about white women who had been lynched for speaking out against the murders. She was verbrent. You know that word? Like she was on fire. She had those women on the edge of their seats. By the end of the speech, every last one of them agreed to sign a national petition and give money to make lynching a federal crime. Mrs. Holland said she knew it was hard to believe that such horrors were happening in America in the 20th century. She pulled a big envelope out of her bag and said she had proof, but warned us not to look at the photographs unless you have the stomach to face the evil men can do. I thought I should look at the pictures to see if there was something I could use in the column. I didn't get past the first one. Two black men were hanging by their necks on a post, like one you'd hang a sign on. Their hands had been tied behind them. Their feet were just a few inches off the ground. On either side of the bodies, dozens of white men were lined up and looking straight at the camera. Some of them were leaning forward to make sure they got into the picture. And if that wasn't horrible enough, the picture was printed on a postcard. What kind of person would put a stamp on a thing like that? And who on earth would he send it to? I went back to my room feeling sick about the whole human race and spent the weekend trying to squeeze as much of what I'd seen and heard into a few paragraphs. I was sure that Cornish would cut the whole thing, but I was going to try. Didn't a story about women trying to right a terrible wrong belong on the women's page? When Cornish read it, he practically ran into Mort's office and closed the door. They were in there for what seemed like a very long time, and when they came out, Mort marched out of the newsroom with his head down and my story in his hand. Cornish said he was taking it to the publisher, who would make the call. I started to wonder if I was going to get fired. But believe it or not, they ran the story. The sister-in-law had already telephoned the publisher to make sure that her meeting was mentioned in the paper. The secretary upstairs told me there had been a lot of phone calls that morning and a visit from the publisher's wife, who was a big supporter of the anti-lynching campaign. They took out what I wrote about the postcards, and they did not print the names of the women who had been there. They also buried it. Seen and Heard was usually featured on the women's page, but this time it started on the bottom, and most of it jumped to the back of the classified section. People found it anyway, and some of them called to cancel their subscriptions. One man said that his wife had fainted when she read the gruesome details and threatened to sue the newspaper. Believe me, there was nothing gruesome in that article, but there were a lot of disgusting phone calls. It was the first time I heard the word nigger, and I heard it a lot. On the other hand, Miss Cavendish got a lovely note from an important Unitarian minister who thanked her for paying attention to such a national disgrace. The president of Wellesley College and a state senator sent compliments, too. Mort said it would all be forgotten by the next day. I guess it was, but in my little corner of the world, it was a big event. Miss Chevalier called to find out if I had written the piece. She said it was magnificent. I only wish your name had been on it. Betty got 5 copies of the newspaper and sent my story to the president of the National Council of Jewish Women. She told me they came out against lynching even before Leo Frank was lynched in Georgia back in 1915. I hadn't known that. or even that my sister was a member. The most surprising thing was how much Ian Cornish loved the commotion. He sat on the edge of my desk and talked to me like we were old friends. "It's good to ruffle the feathers on those silly hats." I said it was a shame that so much had been cut out of the story, and he gave me a lecture about how nobody but the writer ever knows what's missing. He said it happens to everyone, even me. It took me a minute to realize that the man was flirting with me. "You need thick skin to do this job, which is why the ladies don't last long, especially not young ladies with skin as lovely as yours." And then he asked me out to dinner. I said no, but he didn't give up. He went on a flattery campaign. He liked how I had changed the part in my hair, he said. My red scarf was smart. He complimented something I'd written. Nice turn of phrase. I think I might have said yes to a cup of coffee except for his breath. Some men in the newsroom slurred and staggered in after drinking their way through lunch. Cornish held his liquor better than most, but I knew better than to go near a drunk, even for coffee. He kept asking me out, and I kept saying no, until the day he showed me an invitation to the big opening night party for the Metropolitan Theater. It was going to be a dress ball, the most extravagant party ever seen in Boston. Serena would have been the natural choice to write it up, but she had disappeared, and I knew why. Tessa Thorndike was expecting a baby. Corner said that he was thinking of turning the whole page over to a seen-and-heard report on the gala. "I could send you, but you've never done anything this big before. I'd be sticking my neck out." I thought he was telling me that I was going to cover the party, so I started thanking him, promised I'd do a good job, wouldn't let him down. He stopped me. "Just a minute, kiddo." I would have to get the story without tipping anyone off why I was there, so no taking notes. I would have to bone up on who's who and what's what. He said, "We can go over it at dinner." I didn't have the assignment. Cornish had me over a barrel. "Don't worry," he said. "It's just business. But since we have to eat, I know where to get the best steaks in town." That didn't sound like business to me. Buying a girl a steak dinner was an expensive proposition, and a lot of men expected something in return. But I really wanted to do that story. And I wasn't a gullible kid anymore. I knew to keep my guard up. So I said I'd meet him. The address he gave me was a Chinese laundry, which meant we were going to a speakeasy. If Cornish hadn't already been waiting for me, I probably would have snuck off. But he grabbed my arm and walked me through the store and into my first saloon. Glamorous it was not. There was no music or dancing, the tables were bare, and none of the cups matched. I'd never been anywhere so shabby. But even on a Thursday night, it was packed to the rafters. Cornish ordered us tea, which was whiskey and disgusting. "Maybe you'd prefer wine," he said, and told the waiter to bring me a glass of grape juice, which tasted pretty much the same as the tea. I didn't drink that either, but he didn't let it go to waste and ordered two steak dinners rare. "I want them bleeding," is how he put it, and another round of tea. I tried to talk about the gala. I asked what time I should get there and what to do if I didn't recognize someone. He only wanted to talk about himself and his career. His first big assignment covering the mayor's race in Manchester, murder stories from the crime desk in Worcester, a juicy scandal in Providence. The transcript was just another stop on his way to New York. The big time. By the time they brought dinner, Cornish was too drunk to cut his meat, so I started to put my coat on. "Don't give me the fish eye," he said. "I only drink because I'm stuck in that damned hen coop. Once I'm out of there, I'll be a goddamn choir boy." One of the waiters came over and told him to pipe down or he'd throw us out. Cornish pretended to lock his mouth with a little key. I said I was leaving, but he said, "I thought you wanted to talk about how you're going to make a big name for yourself at that swell party." That set him off about how women didn't belong in the newsroom. Old prunes like Flora and Catherine were okay, but you're too pretty, he said. And if I wanted to write, I should go home and write sonnets about bluebirds or a romantic story for the Saturday Evening Post. But for God's sake, don't do any more poor Negro stories. It makes you look dumb. Colored people don't feel things the same as you and me. It's a scientific fact they have smaller brains than us. Besides, all these campaigns are run by the communists, and that means the goddamn Jews are behind it. These people will destroy the country if we let them. I could hear my mother's voice. They smile in your face, but if you scratch a little, they'll try to cut your throat. That was it. I started for the door. Cornish got himself out of his chair and stumbled after me, but I had to help him through the door and then prop him against a lamppost. He leaned over to kiss me, and if I hadn't caught him, he would have fallen on his face. If you get me a cup of coffee, I'll make a real pass at you. What a jerk. I told him to go to hell. A taxi pulled over and unloaded a bunch of college boys, and I jumped in. It was my first taxi ride, and I'm glad I did it, but oh my God, it was expensive. I didn't eat lunch for a week. The next morning, Cornish was back on the edge of my desk and said, "You'll forgive me if I was a little fresh, won't you, kiddo? I should never mix wine and whiskey." I didn't answer him, and from then on he got nothing but the cold shoulder from me. Finally, he went back to acting like I didn't exist, which was a relief.